Hey everyone, I'm Hattie O'Neill and this is Eerie. For the first time, we will be exploring murder, mayhem, and ghosts, of course, down under. I'm a huge fan of Australia. Not their bugs, those kind of scare me, but everything else. And today, we're going to be talking about Port Adelaide. In case you didn't know, Australia was found by English explorers in 1770, though, of course, a Dutch explorer had happened upon it over 150 years before that. In 1778, the first British settlement was established in Sydney and was started as a British penal colony. Surprisingly, they realized it was an island only in 1803, when a navigator by the name of Matthew Flinders made a trip around the island. And then in 1824, the island was renamed from New Holland to Australia, which is, of course, now beloved by everybody. Port Adelaide was founded in 1836 when Colonel William Light sailed up the Port River. It has been the gateway for trade and commerce for South Australia ever since then. The new landing place was officially opened in 1840, but at the time was called Newport. In 1855, Port Adelaide was declared a corporated town and then was made a city in 1901, the same year that Australia's flag was actually adopted, so that's kind of cool. In case you needed some fun facts about Australia, you should also know that Port Adelaide also has another nickname, Port Misery. At the time of its founding, Port Adelaide was built on mud and all of the obnoxious things that come with that, for example, mosquitoes, more bugs, and disease. There are accounts of people being taken to Port Adelaide by ship, once they arrived on shore, the crew threw their luggage into the mud, and then the new residents would have to try to trudge through the thick, slimy earth to reach their stuff and then go back to the small town. Port Misery also worked as a nickname due to all of the crime and murders that took place there. Our first story for murder and mayhem is that of Broadway Kate. Broadway Kate is one of the legends of Port Adelaide, and for good reason. I found a blog with a gentleman's experience with witnessing the ghostly form of Broadway Kate. He was on a ladder painting a building that was being restored in the historic district. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw a white figure, clearly a woman, in a flowing white dress with a large floral hat and holding an umbrella. He slowly turned his head, and the figure glided into an old building and disappeared before his eyes. Immediately after she disappeared, he heard a loud ruckus, like someone tripping over something and falling, or perhaps somebody falling down a flight of stairs. He cautiously climbed down from the ladder and went over to investigate, and he found absolutely nothing. There's nothing that could have created such a noise. He had a chill run down his spine, and he claims that all the hairs on his body stood on end for over an hour. The door and all the windows to this building had been nailed shut. What on earth did he really just see? And where could it possibly have gone? So Broadway Kate earned her nickname by stowing away on the USS Broadway, making her way from Melbourne to Port Adelaide. She told people that her name was Irene Dennis, and that she was there to be on the stage and that she loved theater. She unfortunately never earned her fame for acting, but was instead known around the town for being drunk and disorderly in the streets, and also for flirting with men quite a lot. She was quite often drunk on almost a daily basis at different points. So after Australia's involvement in World War One, women became a lot more confident, restless, and aggressive, and they began to drink, smoke, cuss, and even ride motorcycles, a la Rose from the Titanic. Broadway Kate was clearly no different. So Broadway Kate, you know, got herself into some trouble for her shenanigans. She first appeared in the news in a report of court records. Apparently they reported on those back in the day. It was like headline news. So on the July 15th, 1929 edition of the news, she was being prosecuted for being drunk in the street. The court officials encouraged her to go back home to Melbourne. She appeared pretty regularly in the news for these incidents, and eventually began receiving sentences for time to be served. The longest sentence that she received was 4 months in prison for her behavior. So, on May 25th, 1933, Broadway Kate was reported dead by Theodore Ostlund, her boyfriend of 2 or 3 years. Theodore was interviewed by the police, but he claimed that he had believed she was sleeping. He told investigators that he had claimed, He told investigators that he came back from work, and she was laying on the mattress. Note that when the police found her, she was half on, half off of the mattress, so I don't know who sleeps like that, but you are a whole nother form of chaos that I'm not privy to. Anywho, he assumes she was sleeping, got a cup of tea, and went to bed. He woke the next morning, and she had not moved, so he went to work and let her sleep. When he arrived home the second evening and found her unmoved, he decided to investigate. The police came to investigate, and she was in fact deceased. Kate was half on and half off the mattress, like I said. Her post-mortem examination was performed by Dr. Allison Porter, who had been working as a doctor there for some time. She had bruising on her legs and abrasions on the left side of her face and her chin. Part of her kidney was sent off to be tested as well. Oh no! Oh no! Sorry guys, camera issues. Shit. Well, it's not a kids podcast anyway, right? Oops. Alright, back to where I was. A bottle of medicine that smelled of carbolic acid and an empty bottle of wine was found near Kate as well. When Theodore was questioned about her bruises and abrasions, he stated that she had fallen down the stairs. It was decided that she died of alcohol poisoning, and there were no further questions about his involvement. What the hell? My camera? Being a dick. Okay. We'll see if it saves. I don't know. I just don't know. Okay. Where was I? Oh, yeah. Fun fact, Theodore Ostlund was known for his history of violence and going to court over it. So, I think they should have looked into her death a little bit more. Yeah. So, there was one incident where a man hit him. So, in retaliation, he took a hatchet to the guy's head, and it exposed the guy's skull. Like, he had spent a long time in the hospital to heal from that. Yeah. Seems like he's a stand-up guy, right? In the June 15, 1933 issue of the news, Broadway Kate's true name was revealed to be Ivy May Hall from Melbourne, and she was only 31 at the time she died. She was laid to rest in the West Terrace Cemetery in Adelaide, but people still apparently see her spirit walking through the streets of Adelaide, dressed in her long white dress and her bonnet and her umbrella. So, I don't know. So, the next mysterious death that made the news in Port Adelaide was the death of a Chinese sailor. Please don't hate me if I pronounce your names wrong, because I am I'm not uneducated, but I'm not educated in this matter, so don't hate me. Li Pao Song. On the 6th of September 1944, ship captain Hilton Johnson reported two crewmen who he believed had deserted his ship, Wu Su Ling and Li Pao Song. On September 9th, Wu Su Ling was found in Port Adelaide, subsequently arrested and then taken to his ship in Fremantle. Wu told the police that he had tried to enlist so that he could fight with them and avenge his family. A month later, on October 3rd, Captain John W. Renton, who happened to be the master mariner of the Harbor Board, spotted a body floating in the water of Birkenhead Wharf. Fearing the body would float away before he could get the police to the scene, he tied the body to a crossbeam under the wharf and then phoned the police. Constables arrived on scene, but when they tried to lift the body out of the water and into the boat, they realized that the body had been weighted down by something. The police then decided to tow the body to a small beach at the end of the wharf. Detective Bond and Detective Inspector Sheridan arrived at the beach and transported the body to be examined. The corpse was an Asian man in his 40s. He was dressed in a pullover and the three-quarter length navy trousers, typical attire of sailors in that day. He had no shoes, socks, and no hat. He was wearing a watch that had stopped at precisely 2:35. The body had been wrapped in a red blanket, with an additional gray sheet beneath that. His head was covered in a Hessian bag. And for anyone who didn't know what a fucking Hessian bag was, and was clueless like me, I googled it, so you're welcome. It turns out it's a burlap sack or a gunny sack, so now when I see little cheerful country-themed Christmas decor with burlap sacks, I'm going to think about a dude's head in it, so... You're welcome. You're with me. Anyway. His head had been severely battered. A hemp cord was coiled around his neck twice, then knotted, coiled an additional four times, and then topped off with a reef knot around, like, under his chin. Yeah. I wonder who knew how to tie a reef knot. Some people. Anyway, he also had 3 4-inch nails driven the full length into his skull, so that's pleasant. And the man was clutching 2 heavy iron pieces called spanners. I looked some of that up, and it looks like it's a wrench, and I don't know why you would call it something other than a wrench, but I'm not a man, so I don't know, whatever. The post-mortem examination was completed by a government pathologist, Dr. John Burton Cleland, and he found massive trauma to the man's head. Dr. Cleland found the nails in Li Pao Sung's head as well, and he believed a hammer was used rather than any other object as they were driven the full way in. No thanks. The body was identified as Li Pao Sung thanks to his fingerprints. Australia actually required any foreign sailors to be fingerprinted upon entry to their ports as a way to keep track of anyone coming into their country. So, the discovery of his body incited a lot of wild reports in the news. So, in the October 5th issue of the news, they put forth several theories, including... theories like a Chinese puppet government had killed him, that he was the victim of a ritual of the Tong Society, that he had asked a friend to drive the nails into his head as a form of suicide that was apparently popular in China at some point, or perhaps he was a victim of a gang killing. These ideas were entertaining, but the police believed that Lee's murder was a sailor due to the knots in the rope around his neck. The police began to look into the ship's logs, and sailors reported missing around this time, and then their investigation took off. Lee had been reported missing, along with another crew member. After this discovery, the police put a warrant out for Wu Su Ling's arrest in connection with the Lee murder. The Adelaide police worked with the Colombo police, communicating back and forth, and the Colombo police arrested and held Wu Su Ling until the Port Adelaide police could arrive. Detective Sergeant Gill was assigned to retrieve him from Sri Lanka, and then bring him back to Australia. Wu Su Ling was a 29-year-old Roman Catholic from China with a wife. I don't know why he would have told the police that he wanted to join the military to avenge his family, unless maybe he was talking about, like, brothers or parents or something. I don't know. He claimed that he was sleeping in the cabin with Lee, and Lee was sleeping on the couch on the evening of his murder. Wu was awoken that night to find his friend Liu Yung Fui, could be completely butchering that, I'm sorry, with Lee's body on the floor. Wu went to call out when Liu held a knife to him and said, "Don't shout out or I will kill you." Followed by, "This man killed my brother some time ago and I have taken revenge. Don't you dare say anything either to the captain or the police." Wu then helped Liu Yung Fui carry Lee's body out and throw it overboard. Wu stated that he was too afraid to ask Liu how he had killed Lee. Wu went ashore the next day to find someone he could confide in, but found no one who spoke his language. He then returned to the ship. He did the same thing the next day and ended up befriending an Australian soldier, and they ended up drinking. But the soldier convinced him that he should join the army. Wu made his way back to the ship and then discovered it had already left port. He had shown his attempted enlistment papers to the police when they arrested him on the first time, like a few days after he was reported missing. The ship was summoned back to Port Adelaide, and the captain and crew were also questioned. Multiple crewmen stated that Wu Su Ling and Liu Yung Fui were friendly and often gambled with each other. Lee was not a gambler and was known for having a lot of money. One of the crewmen had heard someone screaming and then a thumping sound between midnight and 3 a.m., but did not investigate. On September 6th, the same day that Captain Johnson reported Lee and Wu missing, he was also in the office allowing Liu Yung Fui to discharge as captain's boy, even giving him 20 pounds towards his required 100-pound fee to be released from his contract. Upon learning this, the police got a warrant for Liu Yung Fui. On October 11, 1944, Detective McGrath apprehended Liu in Newcastle and brought him back to Adelaide for questioning. Liu Yung Fui was 36 years old, from China, and had a wife and two children. When he was questioned about Lee's death, he told an opposing story, of course. Liu stated that Wu tried to persuade him to assist him in murdering Lee. Liu also claimed that he had seen Wu with three large nails. And I know that information was probably in the paper, but I think that's kind of fishy that he just happened to give that information to the police and notice his friend with three nails. I mean, you don't just walk around like, "Look at these cool nails I got." It seems weird. Anyhow, Liu claimed that at 2 a.m. on September 5th, Wu came to him covered in blood and crying. Liu then helped Wu cover up the body and throw him in the water. Liu stated that he had asked how he had done it, and Wu told him that he used three nails and that it had been over a family feud. Both Liu Yung Fui and Wu Su Ling were charged with murder and went on trial. Shockingly, both men were acquitted. So then, on January 23rd, 1945, the court recharged them with having conspired to defeat the cause of justice by secretly disposing of Lee's body. This time, they were both found guilty. Liu Yung Fui pled guilty and was sentenced to 3 years and 9 months in prison. Wu Suling pled not guilty and was sentenced to 4 years. And he actually reacted quite outrageously and asked them to just shoot him instead. So that's weird. I don't know. Li Pao-sung was buried on October 6, 1944, 3 days after being found. The Melbourne Steamship Company Limited paid for his funeral expenses, and only those involved in his investigation were actually present at his service, so it's kind of depressing. Li never really received justice. The men who killed him served less than 5 years, and it wasn't even for a murder charge, technically. It's more or less just, like, for concealing his body, so, yeah. There have been lots of reports of visitors seeing a ghostly sailor walking and or stumbling around Birkenhead Wharf. These sightings are also accompanied by sounds of growling and moaning in pain. So is Li still wandering around seeking justice for his brutal and senseless murder? I don't know. So, next, I think it's kind of cool because Port Adelaide actually developed a self-guided walking ghost tour with the help of Alan Tiller of Haunting Australia. So I'll put the link in the description box, but you can actually download the tour for yourself to read and look into further. So I thought that was kind of cool that they actually teamed up to do that with someone. Yeah, I would totally be down to go do this tour in Port Adelaide if you guys ever want me to come sponsor a visit or something. Yeah, so one of the buildings listed on this tour is actually the Port Adelaide Visitor Information Center, and it was built in 1860 and originally served as the customs house, the courthouse, and the police station all at once. Eventually, other things were built, and then it just stayed as only the police station until the 1990s. So, in the building's early days, an incident occurred where a young cadet named Jacob Wilkes went upstairs after a long day to the dorm area to get some rest. When he didn't come down to breakfast in the morning, a fellow cadet was sent to wake him up, but the young man was cold to the touch. He had died sometime during the night. There have been reports of footsteps going upstairs, even walking through walls, cold spots and breezes that defy explanation, and these have all been attributed to the late Mr. Wilkes. Another eerie tale from this building is the ghostly opera singer of a previous inmate's time spent there. So in 1928, there was a strike among the water workers, which was not cool considering the sea level and the mud in Port Adelaide. So this building has endured a lot of water damage over the years, but particularly during this strike. So at this time, a gentleman named Delora was placed in cell block number 5, and was known for singing opera to annoy the police officers who were holding him there. So years later, officers reported hearing singing, and then when they went to investigate, the cells were empty and the singing stopped. So they have no explanation for random opera singing taking place inside of what used to be jail cells. The next stop is the former casualty hospital. The port was busy, and considering we already know about, you know, how violent it was, they clearly need a doctor and a hospital there. So, as I said, Port Adelaide was incorporated in 1855, but it wasn't decided that a small clinic was needed until 1859. And then it wasn't even constructed until 1861 due to funding. So Dr. Duncan was placed in charge of the casualty hospital, but there were some limitations on what he could actually do. If anyone had a disease or infection, they had to be sent to Adelaide by train. Not too smart for communicable diseases or pandemics. You know, just a thought. He could not accept any female patients whatsoever. He could take female corpses, but that's a different story. And Dr. Duncan was able to treat trauma patients only. Originally, he couldn't even accept corpses until an incident where a local hotel left a dead body on display for the public to see. Because at the time, they would hold inquests in the hotels. I mean, I didn't write the laws back then, I don't know. Interesting stuff, man. It should also be noted that this original building was a one-room ward for those who needed healing. A not-so-savory incident occurred when Magistrate G.W. Hawker was visiting, and he found a decomposing female corpse on the floor next to a patient that was very sick. So he was McPissed and insisted to store the corpses in the cells of the police station next door, which is also now the visitor center. So inmates shared their cells with the dead for several months until a dead house, aka a morgue, could be constructed. The hospital got a much needed update in 1884 with the addition of rooms, which included a men's and women's ward, a matron's ward, and a kitchen. Surprisingly, only 6 deaths occurred at this hospital, but there were 15 amputations. So if you were to visit the former hospitals today, you may hear the sounds of groaning that are said to reverberate through the halls. And often, people hear footsteps and voices talking, but when they investigate, they find themselves alone and no plausible source for the sounds. Perhaps, if you go at the right time, or maybe it depends on the person, Dr. Duncan has been seen roaming within the walls of his former hospital. I wonder what instigates his sightings, and I would honestly love to be one of the people to just, like, see him, but I don't know. Anyway, alright, so maybe the most iconic landmark in Port Adelaide is its lighthouse, and like all good lighthouses, it is haunted. The original lighthouse was located closer to the mouth of Port River, and it was first lit in 1869. It served from that location until 1901, until it was dismantled. After being decommissioned, and its parts were used to construct other lighthouses. So, the lantern or light from this original lighthouse was installed at the lighthouse in Wanga Shoal. In 1912, this lighthouse was struck by a ship called the Dimsdale, and 2 lightkeepers, Henry Franson and Charles McGowan, were killed as the lighthouse fell into the ocean. And also I just keep thinking of the Fairly Odd Parents when I hear about Dimsdale, so I would like to get that out of my head somehow. Alright, so, the tower to the original lighthouse and the keeper's house were moved to South Neptune Island, and it stood an impressive 55 meters, above sea level, and it could be seen from 61 kilometers on a clear day. It was decommissioned in 1985 and then restored, and then the lighthouse was placed at its current location in 1986, and it is maintained by the South Australian Maritime Museum. There are reports of ghostly children around the lighthouse. Some people believe that one of the lightkeepers on Neptune Island had small children. And some people claim that it could be involved with 2 missing children in the 80s, but I don't know, obviously. No idea. Reports have also been found from the South Neptune Island lighthouse keepers. They apparently felt very uneasy at the lighthouse, and one reported the feeling of having someone constantly stand behind them the entire time they were there tending the light. And there was also the mysterious disappearance of the lightkeeper named George Marmont, who went fishing on the rocks one morning and then was never seen again. So, I don't know. Our last creepy tale is the ghost boy of Lipson Street. So, late at night, whether you're out enjoying a walk or out in the town drinking at the pub with your friends, you may happen upon a young boy in period clothing wandering around the streets, staying more in the shadows. Sightings of this small boy are believed to be related to the death of a little boy from 1901. This boy was named Alfred Johnson, and he was only 6.5 years old. And that's important because when you're 6, half years are very important. I remember this. And he helped his grandfather, James Foster, with his business. On that fateful day, Alfred ran quickly to James to let him know that he needed to deliver roots to a customer. They used a low, heavy horse called a dray attached to a cart. At some point in their trip, Alfred took the reins, but he pulled too far to the left on the dray's harness. Alfred was then thrown to the ground and hit his head on the rocky path below. James rushed him to the doctor to evaluate him, but sadly the doctor looked him over and declared that Alfred had died. Is Alfred still trying to make deliveries with his grandfather to this day? Perhaps you should go and find out. I'm sure some of you can get there faster than me. Anywho, that's going to wrap up this episode. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you have the chance, I hope you visit Port Adelaide for its history and its haunts. I know if I ever get the chance, I'm so going. Thank you for listening. If you want to see photos associated with this episode, check out my Instagram at @eeriepodcasthattie. I would love it if you would leave me story suggestions, or if you have your own story that you would like read on my show. My email is eeriepodcast@gmail.com. I have exclusive content on my Patreon page. I've got bonus content, bonus pictures and videos. There's exclusive merch, and you can have a shout out on my show, whatever. But that website is patreon.com/eeriepodcast. If you would like any sweet merch, you can go to my Etsy store. Just go to Etsy and search Eerie Podcast, and that is the only store by that name. So, also, I would like to give a shout out to CK for always being awesome and supportive, and you should totally check out his show, Mirths and Monsters. It's just lovely, and I love listening to his show, so you should check it out too. Anyway, keep it creepy. I hope you enjoy the show, and until next time, that's gonna be it. See ya.